Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am O'Brien McMahon, and this is People Business. In this episode, I'm joined by Patty Temple Rocks. Patty is an advertising and communication expert, having served as managing director at Golin, chief reputation officer at Leo Burnett, and chief communications and brand officer at Dow Chemical. In 2019, she released her first book, I'm Not Done, It's Time to Talk About Ageism in the Workplace, which was ranked as one of the 9 books every professional should read in 2019 by Inc. magazine. And Kirkus Reviews said, Rocks writes succinctly but convincingly about the proliferation of age bias and its damaging, insidious, and demoralizing effects on business and employees alike. She makes a compelling argument for a spirited call to action against workplace age discrimination. Patty recently released a second edition of that book called I'm Still Not Done because the impact she saw the pandemic have on older workers and the way that they are treated. It is really that book and that work that we unpack in this conversation. We talk about what ageism is, how it shows up, and how to think about and talk to our older workers and the opportunity that is there if we can be a little creative, be a little flexible, be willing to communicate. And how we can utilize the talent that is there in our older workforce. Hope you enjoy this episode. If you are interested in connecting with Patty or interested in connecting with me on this topic or any other topic on this show, always love those conversations. That's why I do this. I love these conversations and learning about this stuff and discussing this stuff and changing how we think about these things. Please reach out to me through LinkedIn. That's the best way. Send me a direct message on there or comment on a post. Would love to keep the conversation going. That's it. Without further ado, here is Patty Temple Rocks, who, by the way, has the best name. That is actually her name, but it just sounds like a walking affirmation. Patty Temple Rocks. Patty, welcome to the show. Very excited to talk about a conversation, a topic that I honestly hadn't thought that much about. And I think that's the point of the work that you're doing is people don't really think that much about this. But it does have an impact on a huge portion of our population, and that is ageism. And so we talk about a lot of other isms, but ageism is not one that gets a lot of credit. So welcome to the show and excited to dive in.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here. And you're not alone. Ageism is literally the most commonly experienced ism of all the isms out there and the least reported or talked about. So you're not the only one that maybe doesn't think about it as much as we should.
Yeah. Well, let's define it to kick this thing off. What is ageism?
Sure. And the main distinction, I think, to understand is that there is age discrimination and there is ageism. And discrimination is an act, you know, that is sort of legally protected, whereas ageism is more like an attitude of behavior. And ageism is really, like, to me, the most common way that it's experienced and expressed is just unconsciously making assumptions that people of a certain age are fill in the blank, not creative anymore, don't want to be there, are have one foot out the door, are slower to learn, you know, all these stereotypes that are not true about older people. I mean, my focus has always been in the workplace. So that's kind of the environment that I'm seeing it in and comfortable talking about.
Yeah. And I may ask you some ignorant questions so you can slap me virtually here as we go. But I do want to kind of pick this apart, play devil's advocate a little bit
Sure.
with you as we go. And one of the questions I have to start is like, has this always been a problem? Or is it that people at an older age are changing? Like I think about my grandfather when he was 65 and what he was and my own father, his son, who is now 71 and is living an entirely different lifestyle, way more active, way more able and capable, physical, you know, getting down on the ground and rolling around with my kids, you know, going out in the woods with some weight on his back and hiking around. And we went skiing with him last year. Like, I feel like, is this just like, we've kind of always misjudged old people? Or is it like our definition of old people is change?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, laws protecting age have been around for much longer than sort of the changing demographics or population. So there was clearly ageism. before, but it is very different now. And I think that your description of your dad is a perfect example. Like, we are living, and we are living in a vital way, a good, you know, two decades longer than our predecessors. And there's all sorts of implications for that. I think that the business world, frankly, was asleep at the wheel. We should have seen that coming. The boomers are the largest population group. And as they were aging, the significant numbers, therefore, in the workplace, just because of strictly population-based, we should have sort of realized, okay, we can't, our normal assumptions that somebody might be ready to retire at 60 need to be questioned. Because, first of all, financially, a lot of people can't afford to retire at 60 anymore. When you were, your grandfather, I don't know how long your grandfather lived, but in the, you know, the life expectancy for men used to be in the low 70s. So if you retire at 60, 65, you're looking at a shorter period of time than today where you need to be able to pay for things. And so, you know, there are some people that are very focused on this issue of the large number of aging so-called workers, partly because who's going to take care of this huge number of people if they don't have the ability to keep working and taking care of themselves? So I think it's totally accurate and fair to say there are some things that make this a bigger issue now than it was 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah. But I do like your point that these laws were put in place with previous generations, like that this has been a problem for a while. That was right. A good point. So let's unpack it a little bit more. What does it look like? Do you have some examples that can maybe make this real for how this shows up differently for folks?
Sure. I mean, I think, and I'm a glass half full person by nature, so I like to think that a lot of these things that are done to people are unconscious or just people not really thinking. And so there's a lot of assumptions made that somebody of a certain age should not invest training in them. Let's spend our training dollars on, I've heard this by many people in your profession, with someone with a longer runway. So someone who's 30 has a chance to be with the company a lot longer than someone who's 50. Well, there's a whole bunch of things wrong with that. Training should be, you know, it's used as a recruitment retention tool. It's also necessary. So sometimes the training is to help people stay abreast of new trends and things like that. And then I think we also should know by now that the loyalty of and I'm not practicing reverse ageism here, but the loyalty of somebody in their 30s is very different than the loyalty in somebody of their 50s. And it may be a function of the fact that it's a lot easier for a person in their 30s to leave and find another job, because age discrimination also happens, or ageism, when someone is actively looking for a job if they're over 50. So I think, you know, that's just one example where if you just look at the population of a workforce and randomly question everybody over 50, how many training opportunities have they been given? Not many. I also think that another form of ageism that is all too common, and it's all too common in part because it's really hard to identify and be sure that's what it is, but it's marginalization. And so a lot of people that I interviewed for my book and have subsequently talked to said that it was really subtle and slow. And all of a sudden they realized they weren't being invited to some of the same meetings that they used to be. Or if they were, sometimes their opinion wasn't sought, you know, in ways that it used to have been. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, because then you've got the person thinking, well, maybe I'm off my game and that's why this is happening to me. But then if you're not in the meeting or in the conversation, how are you going to have the most meaningful contribution to make? So
yeah, you're subtly gaslighting them.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
How does this show up differently for men and women?
That's a really good question. And it's honestly the reason I wrote the second edition to my book. As I mentioned at the beginning, the ageism is the one form of discrimination that it can affect everybody. It's the most commonly felt because it doesn't matter your sexual preference, your religion, your race, your gender. And frankly, I was kind of, my ambition and my goal was to create a mini movement here to get people as upset and angry and willing to take action about ageism as we were during the Me Too movement, you know, which I think did help people to see things in a new light. So I consciously made a choice to not really focus on women because, again, it can happen to everybody. And I'm going to also come back to a point about men that I want to make, because then what happened was I got so much feedback from people who would basically say, well, come on, you know what's worse for women. Come on, why aren't you talking about this? And so I wanted to dig a little bit deeper. And there are definitely things that are worse for women. Women suffer from much more than men, and suffer is a very strong word, but from something called lookism. And you've probably, you know, seen the HR-centered research that sometimes it's easier for so-called attractive people or people who fit our normative views on what beauty looks like to get an interview, to even get the job. Well, you start to age and women are told, oh my God, you better dye your hair or you better get some Botox. Your wrinkles are showing. Those conversations are simply not happening with men. Men are told they look more distinguished. They're certainly not told you should get Botox and dye your hair. And I would need all my digits to tell you how many women have told me that they were told to dye their hair. That's what
by
I was
men,
women.
Were they told by men to dye their hair?
No, not always by men.
Sometimes okay, good. Because that's just gross.
Yeah, yeah. No, some women as well. But women who were, I think, trying
women
to
Women guiding
help.
Other women to try to help. Yeah.
Right, okay. To try to help. And I, by the way, would never say, don't do it. You know, do what you need to do. Do what makes you happy, all the rest of that. But it shouldn't have an impact on a person's job expectations or performance.
For sure.
The other thing that I noticed, and this was clearly during the pandemic for me, was I happened to have a team that was mostly women. And in the early days, as we all remember, it was the wild, wild west. We didn't know how long it was going to last. We didn't know what to expect. You know, we were at home and then slowly we were getting out and there was homeschooling, but then certain daycares were opening and every day was a new thing to try to figure out, whether it's, you know, I was on many a call where it was someone then just got a text, oh my God, somebody in my son's preschool has COVID. I got to go get him. Or every morning you're taking the temperature, all these things. And we are still a maternally biased society. And so women were doing that. And women were dealing with the unbelievable pressure of trying to manage their jobs during COVID and their families more at a higher rate than men. And often, not often, but I mean, again, these are HR statistics. You know that a lot of people dropped out of the workforce during that time and just said, it's too much. I've got to focus on my family.
There are a lot of articles. I even wrote something on LinkedIn about it because there was a period where my wife had COVID when you had to quarantine for 14 days. And so she spent 16 days in our master bedroom and I had our then 2-year-old while trying to pitch business, deal with client situations and be a full-time dad. And it was, I mean, it was a great test. I like being tested to see what I'm capable of, but man, I'm glad it was 16 days and not my entire life. And moms do have to do that more than dads do.
And it's not to say that there aren't a lot of dads like you, because there are. I was married. My husband was a stay-at-home dad. And I always say I could never have had the career that I had without that. So I do believe that, again, our society values are changing a little bit and that is more accepted, but it's still the exception, you know, not the norm. And there's a couple of factors. So those same women that said, and most of them were in their 30s, you know, with smaller children in my profession, if I look at that, then, you know, they're ready to sort of step back in. But they've missed a number of years. And so now they're stepping back in with more gray hair, with not being, you know, having those experiences during those intervening years. And so they're that much more vulnerable to ageism. Two caveats, if you'll let me, that I want to make, because I think that they're also true. You know, it's sort of like I'm a firm believer that two things can be true. I interviewed a gentleman for my book who was marginalized and then ultimately pushed out of the workforce in his 50s. You know, what he said to me was about the whole gender question. He said, you know, this isn't probably the most politically correct way to say it, but he said, I'm an easy one to push out. If you're a person of color, they're going to think twice because of litigation risks and some other things. If you're a person of color and a woman, you know, I have nothing. I'm just an easy one. I'm a white male over 50. Bye. Done. You're done. And I think there is, that's fair. Like, I think that is very fair. And I know, you know, I talk to many men, so I don't want to imply that this doesn't sort of happen to men. It does. And I also think that, because I've talked to people of color, I think like any form of ism, you know, any ism, if you have more than, you know, the more you have, the more the deck is stacked against you to some degree.
Yeah.
So I do believe that, I don't want to minimize that a person of color might not have an even harder road to hoe, yeah, so to speak, but I just think that it's everybody.
And to that point, I think you go down a negative path, or it gets really messy really quickly when you try to rank order who has it worse.
Right.
And I think we've seen examples of that on social media or in the public, where you get different groups in fighting and everybody sort of positioning to be the biggest victim. I don't think that's productive. There are people in all categories who are treated different ways for different reasons, and everybody has a hard life, whether yours is the hardest or not. You know, who am I to judge, or who are any of us to judge? But I think we can recognize when we are treating, or when we are seeing people being treated poorly, and we can do things to fix them. Regardless of whether it's the worst thing or somewhere in the middle, we should fix things that are fixable.
100% agree. And I'll make a plea for my particular cause here. The thing that is unique about ageism, it is the one thing that we all share, you know?
Yeah.
And so I always
we
think
all get
no,
old. We're all,
we all get old. And the opposite of getting old is dying. And so I don't think any of us, I think we all want to get old. And so that is one common experience that, regardless of who has it worse, we all will experience at some point.
Yeah. This is one we can all share.
Yeah,
for sure. So let's have some fun. Let me play devil's advocate here and throw some things at you, right? Like, the first one is, well, don't people get less creative as they get older? Isn't that a thing? Like, people kind of slow down?
No, it's not a thing. I think there certainly are some things that I think are fair to say that do change as we get older, but creativity is not one of them. And, you know, you need look no more than like Picasso. I mean, some of the greatest creators in our society were creating in the last quarter of their life. So I think that one of the things that, and I always put the lens that I have as a boss, or as somebody that's managed people. And so I think for every stereotype that I hear about an old person, I can find you a young person that I would say the same thing about. Common refrain about old people, they're just not open to try new things. They're very closed-minded. And I'm sure you could too. I would challenge you to look across your workplace, and I bet you could find a Gen Y, somebody who is not open to change either, you know? And so I think that there are, you know, for all of those things, the real solution to have a ageism-free workplace is to put the same filter or lens on every single employee. And if it's not acceptable behavior, like if you're in, you know, in a creative business, you can't afford to have anybody at any age suddenly lose creativity. And so you have to solve that problem. But the way to solve it is not to say it's a problem that only exists in this narrow silo. It's a problem that exists in my workplace. So I've got to figure out a solution. And again, all of the common things, well, they're not digital. You know, they're not very digital, older workers. And, you know, well, let's unpack that a little bit. What does that really mean? And what does your workplace need to solve for? And if they need to solve for getting everybody to move to Slack or something, let's say, you know, I bet you've got a boomer in your workplace who remembers when literally we went from faxing things to emailing things. And so that's not the technology. You've got an IT department that understands the technology. Don't overlook your veteran workforce, who the veterans in your workforce who understand change management and who understand how to bring about a new way to communicate or those sorts of things. So
yeah, well, that's a good point. Because if you think about when 55-year-old entered the workforce, I'm not quick enough to do the math on what year that was, but the internet was not what it is today. Online tools on a computer were not what they are today. And so there was so much manual in-person work being done, fax machines, phone calls, that kind of thing. And then it's not like that population has like totally fallen off and just like thrown up their hands and can't use today's technology. They're engaged in today's technology. There may just be one cutting edge thing that they don't know. So they've proven that they can adapt quite a bit. It's just continuing to your earlier point. It's continuing to invest in the training, just like we invest in a younger person who's becoming a manager for the first time to say, hopefully we invest in them to say, hey, here's what you need to be a leader. Yeah. We don't need to invest in some of the older leaders, maybe as much for leadership, but maybe we do for technology. So we just are investing in different populations in different ways.
Yeah, 100%. You know, one thing that I learned, and I've talked to a lot of recruiters who spilled the truth on this, is that the term digital native, like, I don't know if you've seen that, but a lot of job postings or things like that will say, you know, I want someone that's a digital native. Well, let's unpack that a little bit. What does that actually mean? Well, a digital native would be somebody who literally grew up with a phone in their hand from the time their parents said they could have one at 12. And so they're more familiar with things like Snapchat, or, you know, they're more, that's how they have learned to communicate. And we could, that's a whole separate podcast to sort of talk about whether that's good or bad. Yeah. But it is a simple fact that the only people that can be a digital native, if that's really what we're saying, are people of a certain age. But what the recruiters clue me in on, and that comes with it, a salary expectation. And so what oftentimes when somebody is putting in a job description, and I tell this to young people all the time, it's oftentimes a synonym for, and we're not going to pay very high. We're not going to pay you very well. And so depending on the actual job that's being asked of you, your experience, all the rest of that, don't accept a salary that just assumes I don't have to pay you much because you're young or old for that matter. But really it should be calibrated with the job. And that doesn't really happen enough. And as I said, this whole digital native thing just kind of became a euphemism for cheap.
Yeah. So I have some more sort of myths or whatever that I want to unpack, but I think some of them maybe are a little heavier. So let's save those. We'll table those for a second. And let's just go back to the basic question of, we've been talking about this, what it is. Why should employers care about this? Is there a business case for this?
100%. And I think that it is, first of all, there's lawsuits, you know, and there's litigation. And while many are settled, many are not. And even the ones that are, you know, sort of settled, so to speak, before the person leaves, are cost money, you know, and the average price of sort of addressing an ageism allegation is $250,000. But the actual cost of that is so much greater in the workplace. And I love when I talk to people in your profession, because I know you know this, is the loss of confidence and loyalty to the company. People, when someone sees, when a younger person, the allyship that I have seen from younger people on this issue is so rewarding to me. And so when someone of any age sees one of their colleagues sort of being pushed out the door, literally or figuratively, the cost of that is far more than the dollars saved. Because I don't go, oh, phew, it's never going to happen to me. We're now starting to realize, as I said earlier, that could be me, or that could be my mom or my dad, because now we've got all these young people who've had two career parent households to grow up in, and they know how important these jobs are. So I think it's the lack of trust or confidence when the employee population sees any group treated marginally.
Yeah. Well, that, I think that's one of the things that really got the volume turned up on it during the pandemic, is the world of work leadership had said forever, we can't be remote. This won't work. You need to be here in the office. And then in less than 2 weeks, everybody was remote. I mean, other than manufacturing and some service and that kind of thing. But like the whole office world went remote. And for the most part, it went great. And everybody kind of looked around and goes, oh, okay. Well, if we can do that, and that was just this arbitrary policy, I don't know that I want to work in an arbitrary environment anymore.
Right.
And I think it's just cued people in to recognize when leadership are making arbitrary decisions or doing things for not the right reasons. I think everybody's antenna is way up on that. And we're all very sensitive to that, because we just proved that we could do something you told us we couldn't do. And so don't give us your arbitrary rules anymore. Don't treat us like we're not human beings anymore. Don't lie or do something and pretend like we're not going to notice it. We all do. And I think people are standing up for that a little bit more, or at least are reacting to it in a stronger way than they were before.
No, I agree. And, you know, again, the statistics prove that not just employees care about this, but people prefer to do business with or buy a product from a company that they know treats people well, their own people well. So we are now judged not just by what we sell or do, but by how we treat our own people. And so I think it eventually, you know, literally back to, you know, the business case, so to speak, for addressing this, it can hit your share price. It can impact sales. I mean, big, you know, litigation is costly on all sorts of fronts.
Yeah. So there are some questions that I could see business leaders asking or having in their head. One is, well, we've got to be managing the cost of the business and we need people who show up and do the work in the business. And we can hire two or three people for the cost of this 60-year-old. And they're great, but they're not doing the work the way we need people to do the work. And so if we get rid of five of them, we can bring in 15 others and we can keep this fresh and get our work done. Like, that's a real conversation that I think leadership teams are having. What's your reaction to that type of a conversation?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at that and consider that this is not an entitlement that the organization has to sort of keep people around until they decide that they're ready to leave at any cost. There is our workplace culture over the years has been what I call this incredibly linear sort of thing. Like, you'd get promoted to the next job and then the next job and the next job. Obviously, this is more of a white collar issue, but then you reach a point where maybe you've maxed out. There is no bigger job or higher salary that you're going to get. Or the organization, you know, your salary growth outstrips what the organization can actually afford. And so those are legitimate conversations to have. They're not always comfortable. And so what has been happening more often than not is those conversations are never being had. People are just sort of making arbitrary decisions that I'm going to get rid of these five expensive people and hire 10 or 15 less expensive people, instead of really trying to look with a wide open eyes and a creative win-win approach. Like, is there something different that we could do with these veteran employees that understand our business, understand our culture? You know, maybe this isn't what they should be doing anymore. And I have countless examples that I can share, but I also want to say, and that attitude adjustment also has to happen on the person who would like to keep working well into their 60s or even 70s. You can't go into it expecting that you're going to continue to just sort of make more and more and more and more and more. At some point, you have to say, I really want to just keep working because I love my job. I need the income. A lot of people, literally, they call them the death years, need health insurance until they can get until they get Medicare eligible. So some of it is even just like, let's just have this honest conversation. It might not be easy. What are you really looking for? How can we make this work? And then the people who are most valuable, I hope this is true of any age, are the ones that you're going to try to be flexible with and try to come up with something that can work. And so I tell older people this all the time. You might need to compromise a little bit of your salary, but what do you want? Do you want more freedom? And of course, now in the post-COVID years, these things are, everybody, it turns out, wants it. But you know, prior to COVID,
I think that was one of the biggest myths of the generation differences is like, oh, younger people want flexibility and autonomy. And it's like, yeah, so do older people. Like, what?
Right.
Person do you go like, hey, do you want to go live a happier life? And they go like, no, I'll just keep doing it the way we were doing it.
Exactly.
Everybody wanted that.
And I'm sure that you have personal experience with this. And so do I. Like, what someone wants is only able, you can only uncover that in a conversation. And
yeah,
so 100%. If nobody is having a conversation with people, and this is another thing that is unfortunately all too common, for whatever reason, performance reviews, the compliance in giving people performance reviews, they're not as compliant when people are of a certain age. Like, I talked to so many people who said, I haven't had a review in years. They just sort of fill in the paperwork, get it done, but I haven't had a real sit down review. Well, I can hypothesize as to why I think that is. I think it's because probably the 60-year-old that is in need of a review works for somebody who's 40. And that 40-year-old is a little bit, it's like, it's really hard to tell, you know, this person that they need to do this differently or whatever. And so literally you have this group of older workers who are without feedback, and that's not helpful or healthy either. And so if you, I asked an HR leader in my book, I said, well, how would you handle it? And she said, you should handle a 5-year horizon convert. They do 5-year horizons. And so she's like, those 5-year horizons should never stop. And so if I'm talking to a manager who's 55 and our 5-year horizon conversation, they're comfortable enough and they trust me to say, you know what, I'm thinking like by the time I'm 60, I'd like to retire, or I'd like to work part-time, or I'd like to start to sort of downshift, you know, then it feels safe. You know, I know that I'm going to continue to work my butt off for the company, because this person actually is having this really honest conversation with me about it. But she said, if those conversations, they're real common in when we're younger, you know, like, well, where do you want to be 5 years from now? Or what's your ultimate goal? And she's like, that doesn't stop. It shouldn't stop with somebody just because they're getting older. And again, that doesn't mean as a company, like I might say, well, I'd really like to be CEO of this agency. You know, that's my next job. Well, sorry, you know, I don't think you're right for that job. But what else would you, how else could you contribute? Because you're a valuable person. You're just not our choice for CEO or whatever the next level sort of job might be. But that, it's so uncomfortable for people to have that conversation that it just doesn't happen often enough.
Yeah. Well, uncomfortable conversations are uncomfortable regardless, right? And then there's this dynamic of, you know, we grow up in a society still where we respect old people. You know, we respect our elders. Now, maybe not in the way some other cultures do. And you could say that ageism and pushing people out is disrespectful. And I would agree with that. But I think, well, they're older. We can't tell them what to do. We can't, you know, they're going to react a certain way. You know, we're assuming some sort of reaction on their part. And it can be difficult for a younger person to say to an older person, hey, you're not performing. There's a new set of skills we need you to build.
And so we should be helping our younger managers, train them and help them have those conversations. Because, you know, I'm sure you remember this too. For a while, every other seminar was how to deal with the millennial, how to have millennials. And so it was, I thought what's missing is the flip side of that to millennials to say, here's how you should deal with boomers, or, you know, and some of the most encouraging things I've seen, and they're starting to pop up a little more often, but are affinity groups that are dealing with the concept of age or multi-generations in a workforce. And what I love most about them is none of them seem to be open to age 50 plus. You know, they're about the experience of being older in a workplace, but they're not limited to only those older people. It's younger, older, all the rest of them. And I love this story. Someone told me about how they were having this like robust conversation in one of their meetings about something. I don't even remember what it was. And one of the 25-year-olds said, can you guys help me understand why Citizen Kane is such a good movie? I just think it's dumb.
It's the worst.
And then, I kind of do too. But then she said it sort of evolved into this really great conversation about generational movie moments, you know, and then you just get to know people and understand what motivated them differently. So I love seeing those popping up in the workplace.
Yeah. I feel like I need to caveat that. It's not the worst. It did a bunch of revolutionary things. I studied film in college. So like it did a bunch of great things and was a moment in its time, but it is not held up, and I would argue maybe wasn't as great as people claim it's.
I'm with you.
I just feel compelled to say that if anybody is out there,
how fun to major in film in college. That must have been fun.
So one other sort of devil's advocate thought that I have that pops into my head, and I'm sure other people are too, is like we've all seen, whether in our organizations or others, people sit in positions. We have seen people sort of reach a place and just hold on to that place. And sometimes I've seen it happen with younger people too, where they kind of get into a role that's kind of like the top of their ability level, and then they start to behave not in the best way because you can tell there's some scarcity there and they just want to sort of like keep this role for as long as they can because they're afraid to go out and do something else or afraid that they're not going to be capable of doing something different. And you see that happen. Like the biggest stereotype of that is with older workers where, you know, the person sits in the executive seat and they just sort of become ineffective, but they're not going to move out because they're making a salary and they're getting their benefits. And why would they move on? They don't have to move on. They've sort of positioned themselves to do a lower amount of work. And like, there is a reality to that. How do we blend having those difficult conversations and providing opportunity for young people? Just like any, I don't know that we're going to solve this here in the next 5 minutes, but just any thoughts you have around how organizations address that situation and come to the reality of whether that's what's really happening or something different is happening. So I feel like I'm starting to ramble. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. And I think there's a couple of different ways to look at this. And one of them is that, you know, the reality is that nobody should just get to sit in their job and collect a paycheck. And so regardless of age or anything like that. So if that is, you know, really happening and somebody's just getting complacent, you know, then I think that's a management leadership challenge to sort of do something about. But I think that a lot of times with older people in particular, the reason that that happens is because there is a perceived value to this person as an employee of the organization, whether it's, loyalty or just, you know, look, they may be doing the same job, but they're really good at it. And so I don't have the incentive to move them out. But the reality is you could be hurting your organization sort of lower down the ladder because people do need growth opportunities. And so What I think companies aren't getting right is they're just not being creative in creating opportunities for people. And so two examples that come to mind. One is I was talking to a global creative leader in an ad agency, and she was talking about how, you know, she didn't think she was ageist, but she had this producer whose job was to travel the world producing television commercials all around the world. And she was worried that his age was, you know, becoming a factor and that, you know, maybe he didn't really want to travel. And so she was like, he was on her list. You know, they had just been told you got to have 5% or whatever, whatever. And she said, but frankly, talking to you about this topic has made me realize I need to think differently. So she created a job for this person. And it was a sort of home-based job. You didn't have to travel, but he, in one phone call, the people that were out on the road traveling at cheaper salaries, all the rest of that, could call him and he would have a Rolodex full of ideas of people to call to get this permit or to do this, to do that, to do that. And she said, so he's happy. And I think he honestly, I'm pretty sure he took a little bit of a pay cut, but that was okay because his job had changed a little bit, but he was still in it, you know, and most of the people that
I know. Well, now he's leveraged. Now you're leveraging his skill set. So he's not in one state. He's influencing 8 states. Yeah,
exactly. And it was just, you know, and it was not a position that existed. So there was no sort of org chart that showed this, but it was a recognition of the decades of experience this particular person had. Some legit concern about, I mean, people do have different travel ability and needs and all the rest of that as we age. And so, but what I love most about the story is it was a win-win. You know, it added, It did add a position, but it allowed her to fill the other positions, you know, with less experienced people just because they sort of changed the paradigm a little bit of how they did this job. And another one, I don't know if this is as common as it was a while back, but this whole like corporate executives would have like a chief of staff. And so this position was like the one that is going to make sure that I show up at the right meetings, that I'm properly briefed, you know, that I have all this. Well, I worked for a company, two companies actually, that had this position. And it was always given to a HIPO, a young, high potential person who had great roads ahead in the organization. But I know from working with these people that frankly, they are given those jobs in large part because they're super talented and they also have a great ambition. And so they're doing it and there's nothing wrong with this, but they're also doing it with the eye to that next job. And so I talked, one of them was a client. I talked one of my clients into putting a older worker in that chief of staff position because I said, you know what? She doesn't care about anything but helping you succeed. There is no next job for her. She's not looking for four more bumps from a career growth standpoint. She just has decades of working for this company that knows, you know, when somebody says this, they actually really mean that. That and the younger person hasn't, no, I'm not being critical. They just haven't figured that out yet. And so the CEO did it and thought it was the greatest decision he'd ever made because he's like, talk about nothing but my best interest in mind. That's what this person had. So anyway, and that was just a complete rethink. Like, let's not put a high young person in it. Let's put somebody that's already been in the job and ask them to do this for the next X years. One last example. Most companies consider expat assignments for younger people for the same reason. Well, an expat with kids, it's a much more expensive proposition than somebody whose kids might be grown and out of the house. And so why not? The salary issue isn't a difference maker, but you are not buying somebody's house. You could save a lot of money in how you treat the whole expat challenge if you were a little bit more open-minded about sort of the age range of the people you consider for that role. So I think it's all about, let's find win-win. You know,
what are you going to do when you retire? Oh, you're going to travel? Well, hey, how about we have a couple assignments. You can travel and work and still be contributing, but get some of that experience. Yeah, that's a great idea. I'll admit, I hadn't thought about that. That's really good. Have you seen, I think the movie's called The Intern?
Yeah.
You know that one with Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway? That, I mean, you know, it's a cute little movie, but it paints the picture that you talk about with the chief of staff where he retired as a corporate executive after years and he just got a internship at a tech job and he shows up in his 60s and everybody else is in their 20s and the men don't know how to be, you know, young men and everybody's losing their minds and he's just the stable one who kind of helps everybody on track. And it's, you know, it's a comedy kind of tongue-in-cheek movie, but there is some truth to that too, to bringing in somebody who can help guide.
Yeah. There were a number of companies that started internship programs for older people as a result of that movie. So it did some good, I think.
Yeah. That's great. So we're talking about flexibility. Let's keep on that track. What are other things that you see employers doing to get creative around retirement?
One of my favorite examples is a company that recognized they looked at their employee population base and saw, oh my God, if everybody that's eligible for retirement, because they had a specified eligibility year, takes it in the next 3 years, we're screwed. Because the knowledge that will, you know, sort of walk out the door with them could really hurt our ability to be successful. So they decided to like dig in a little bit deeper and try to sort of understand how people were choosing to sort of communicate when they were retiring. And they found that for whatever reason, and they think they figured out why, people were waiting till like 6 months before they wanted to retire to say, oh, I'm going to retire. Yeah. And when they dug a little bit deeper, they found that people were afraid to announce it any earlier than that because they thought that would send a signal that, well, I'm going to just be phoning it in. You can't count on my hard work or all of these different things. They also found that those same employees that sort of used that 6 month time frame were also unprepared psychologically, financially. And so for many of them, retirement turned out to be an unpleasant, sort of stressful thing. So they thought there's got to be a way of trying to make it better all the way around. And so they did a lot of the training that we were talking about earlier with people saying, let's have these conversations much earlier. And they created basically a phased retirement and gave people this 5-year window that you were expected to, if possible, say, I'd like to retire in the next 5 years so that the company has time to manage the succession. Sometimes the person who's leaving can be part of that succession and train their successor. And it's one of those things where the benefit was all the way around because the people that were actually making the decision to retire were just much more ready in every way, psychologically, financially, and it just worked out is a win-win for everybody. And I think they've also found that it's an effective recruiting tool, you know, that they literally talk about it when they're especially mid-career people so that they take the job sort of knowing that they could potentially stay there till the end of their career and it would be a positive experience.
Yeah. So is it fair to make the assumption that you are not a fan of mandatory retirement ages?
Yeah, I'm not, because I think that it's just so arbitrary and everybody's different. You know, some people at a certain age should retire because of their either interest or other factors, and other people will keep going and contributing. And so I think it kind of misses the performance aspect of a job to just give people an easy out. Having said that, though, I do understand, like, I'm on the board of a bank and we have a mandatory retirement for being a board. And I get it. You know, it's also, there's a fiduciary, you know, it's sort of the expectations and the norm. So I did not refuse this offer to be on the board because of this, but it helped me to know going into it that this is a policy that they have. And actually, while I was on the board, we did elevate it 3 years. So make it 3 years longer than it was. But, you know, so I'm not a fan. I also don't think you can tell a company how to do business. I just think if a company is going to have a mandatory retirement age, they just need to be transparent about it.
Yeah. It's interesting because we have one at my company, but I've seen in the almost 15 years that I've been there, I've seen the approach changing. And so I know that they're open to changing it as different scenarios present themselves. They have kept it, and my understanding of why we've kept it, even though we have people beyond that, is because it's only for the production side, for the sales side of our business. And it is to prevent people from sitting on a book of business and getting complacent, because there is some of that. There is a history of some of that in our industry, and we are really a growth-oriented organization. So you can stay beyond it, but there's sort of this mark where it's, hey, we're at least going to have the conversation. And if you're not a contributing member anymore, thank you for your service. You know, we appreciate what you've done.
Sure.
And if you are, then, you know, we'll keep you on, but we want to have a filter to have that conversation and have some accountability to that. So that's my understanding of why we've added that, you know, flexibility.
A benefit, certainly a benefit to that is based on what we talked about earlier about how difficult the conversation is to have. At least then you know this is the number that we're going to work around. And so it kind of forces.
We're going to have the conversation. It's going to be at this time. And if you're still a great contributing member, there's plenty of examples of people who have stuck on well beyond that time. And if you're not, we really appreciate what you've done. You've been a great part of the organization. And thank you.
Yeah, I think the slippery slope for that is to just make sure it doesn't become kind of a scapegoat, you know, to some degree, as I think we are seeing in politics these days, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, there's the other element, and we're getting better at nipping this in the bud early, but that high performers who behave poorly can be given some preferential treatment. And it's a good opportunity to take some of the people who are maybe lingering in that category and say, thank you for your service, you know, without having to upset that apple cart early. So I think it's a good filter to culturally shift the organization as well.
Yeah, for sure.
One other thing that we had talked about, or that was in your book, I don't think we have talked about it, but it was in your book, was mixing up social events.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, and this was honestly a personal anecdote that I shared in the book, but, you know, much of my career has been in the agency world. And so we like a good party. And so you have parties, and usually the people who volunteer to plan the parties tend to be the younger workers. And so there was this history of having parties that were designed by and for younger people. There was a number of years in a row where it was a theme party, you know, dress like a lumberjack, or, you know, like, I don't know, you know, different things for the holiday party. And at one point, some of the people who were older said, you know, I don't do costumes anymore. Like, I'm not going to, you know, dress up. And of course it was fine, but it made me realize. And so the next year when I appointed the committee, I made sure that I had, you know, a mix of ages, and we had a traditional sort of old fashioned, elegant holiday party. And what I found most interesting was the younger people were like, this is really cool. Like, we should do this more often, you know? And so I just think it was just a small example, but there are so many of those little things sometimes that I think that if you're in the minority population as an older worker in a workplace, then maybe the kinds of social events that are planned are not necessarily accommodating to you, or even, you know, people with kids and, you know, different things. And so that just made me realize that in my own way, I was being ageist by assuming that the 20-something should always plan the parties. And in reality, you get a mix of your employee population to plan, you're going to have a party that appeals to more people.
I love that. I love that. Patty, anything that we have not talked about or any final message that you want to get across on this topic?
Well, there's certainly a lot that we could talk about. So, but I think we've covered some really great stuff. And I so appreciate the fact that you're using your platform to add the conversation around ageism. I guess, you know, if there's one, as I said, I like to try to see the glass half full when I can. And if there has been one thing in the last few years that has really made me happy, it is seeing the response of young people as allies. And it's almost like a lot of other forms of subtle discrimination where they just didn't even see it. And I remember I spoke to a group of graduate students about this. They were doing a unit on discrimination, but of course, age was not one of their topics. And so their professor said, I think we should add this. And so we did. And I encouraged them all to go home. It was the holidays. And I said, and just ask your parents, ask your aunt, ask people if they experienced it. And they came back because their project was due after the holiday. And they came back fired up and mad because they're like, oh my God, yes. And this happened to so-and-so. And, you know, and they were like, all once they sort of opened the conversation, they discovered that people who they felt were vital, good at their jobs, you know, still had plenty to offer, were being marginalized or were worried about being marginalized. And they just feel very strongly that that's not fair. So I think it's, you know, just as in all forms of discrimination, we got to get more people under the tent to say this isn't right. And I think as we do that, our odds of making it better, if not go away, are infinitely greater.
Yeah. Well, I have two great examples in my own house of how it can be done well, because my dad is 71 years old, just turned 71, and he's still running his own small business and doesn't have any plans to retire and does a great job and enjoys it and finds meaning from it. We were just talking about it the other day. And my mom, who's 69, going to be 70 next year, she's a sports photographer for the local high schools and has still got her 30-pound camera running up and down the sidelines, taking pictures and high-fiving student athletes and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, she loves it and is, you know, such a vibrant part of the community because of that work that she's doing. So, yeah, I've definitely seen that example.
All any of us want, and I guess I haven't said this yet, because it's, I never want anybody to think that this is a win-lose thing, that for older workers to win, younger people have to lose. There is room on the boat for all of us. And I don't think that anyone is entitled to keep working forever. I think it is just a matter of we all would just like to have the choice. You know, your mom wants to say, you know, I don't want to run up and down the field anymore. She doesn't want somebody else to say, well, you must be too old to run up and down the field anymore. Yeah. Like, we all just want to be part of the conversation and make our own, choose our own final chapter.
All right. And on that, I will bid you adieu, bid our listeners adieu, and hope you've enjoyed this great conversation on ageism. Patty, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, one last thing before you go. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date with future guests. That's it. Thanks for coming. Go make the most of your business and the people in it.